Hi, this is Trish. Before we get started with Riddles in the Dark, episode 2.12, I wanted to let you know that if you are listening to this before September 22nd, 2013, the Mythgard Institute students are hosting a webathon that day, which is Tolkien Day or Hobbit Day, from 11 a.m. Eastern Time to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, with lots of really interesting segments that'll be going on, a lot of listener interactivity, all through the Netmoot. So please, if you're available that day, we'd love to have you come join us. You can find out more details and get updates on that day by going to the Mythgard site, www.mythgard.org, and then go over to the Academy section of the nav bar, and under Academy, select Student Webathon. That's the page that'll give you all the information, and it'll be updated as we get more and more details. Hopefully, we'll see you on the 22nd. All right, let's go on to Riddles in the Dark, episode 2.12.
Welcome, everybody, to Riddles in the Dark 2.12. And this is Zara Burkholz standing in for Dave Kale. Thanks for taking the time to listen to our humble podcast. And tonight we're going to be talking about dragons.
That's right. Modest and understated. See, it sounded just like. I totally thought that was Dave for a second.
Yeah.
No?
Just like
Okay.
That was the anti-Dave.
That's the anti-Dave. Tonight, yes, we are talking about Smaug. We are going to there are several questions that, you know, I know have been in my mind for a while about how they're going to characterize Smaug. That's one of my biggest questions. I am really excited. If there's, you know, on the shortest of short lists about what I am most interested to see, what I am most looking forward to seeing happen in film two, it is going to be how Benedict Cumberpatch does Smaug. I am really interested to see that. So I want to we're going to talk about some of these things more. But Trish was reminding me just before we started that we had promised in the last episode that we would start off with something else. We would start off with a review of the first clip of the extended edition that they have released onto YouTube. So I'm going to pull up here the YouTube clip. We're going to watch it and comment on it together. Boy, can I just say, between Martin Freeman and Hugo Weaving in this clip, the level of facial expression acting is truly off the charts. One thing that this is kind of reminding me of, just sort of seeing this clip happening, is kind of reminding me of something that I didn't even really pay too much attention to when I saw the first film, but that was just how little Elrond we got. I mean, there was the thing with the, you know, with the strange, you know, light table, you know, moon letter thing. But that was not hugely compelling. We didn't get all that much of it. So just watching Elrond talk for that long was
definitely a change. And here it is.
Not with your companions. I shall be missed. The truth is that most of them don't think I should be on this journey.
Indeed.
I've heard that hobbits are very resilient.
I love that.
Really? I've also heard they're fond of the comforts of home.
Oh, that eyebrow expression was the best.
I've heard that it's upwards to the elves, but they will answer both yes and no. You are very welcome to stay, if that is your wish.
And that's it.
We're going to have to do an eyebrow conundrum. Whose eyebrows are going to be more expressive?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, and then we also have Thranduil. We also have Thranduil, yeah, because... Now, I had an interesting take on this when I watched it. You know, the thing he says at the very end, you're welcome to stay, and he actually says, I understand hobbits are fond of home.
The comforts of home.
I kind of came away with, is he trying to undermine the quest? You know, it's kind of like he's sort of like offering him this temptation of staying in Rivendell and not going on. And it's kind of nefarious almost.
You know, it's an interesting question because, I mean, it does... It does really invite, from that clip alone, I wouldn't think that at all. But when you think back over the rest of the film and the open animosity between, you know, from Thorin to Elrond,
right,
and the only slightly less open hostility between, you know, from Elrond towards Thorin, it is not that I could imagine Elrond doing something underhanded, you know, and trying to sabotage the quest or something, but you could see it as basically him trying to rescue Bilbo, you know.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me. He feels, you know, it's hard to know exactly what his motivation is. It's probably complicated, but it seems like he feels sorry for Bilbo, and he's just trying to give him out if he wants.
And think about it, it's kind of a setup to Fellowship of the Ring, which is, you know, it's a setup so that we understand why it would be that Bilbo would end up retiring in Rivendell. You know, I mean, that's kind of the benign.
Yeah. And you know, another example of, you know, Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh going out of their way to throw in a Tolkien quote Easter egg. You know, go not to the elves for counsel, for they shall say both no and yes. You know, that's not from The Hobbit, of course.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's right, from The Fellowship of the Ring. But it's a saying that Frodo presumably learned from Bilbo. So, you know, I mean, that's very cool. Anyway, so I think I don't know. I'm really enamored of the acting in that scene. I mean, that was,
there's a lot of face in that
scene. Oh my.
There's a lot of face. Yeah.
The amount of the level of interchange, you know, the ratio of, you know, emotional content to words of dialogue was really, really high.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah,
you know, I just thought of another motivation for Elrond. It could be maybe he wants to learn about hobbits.
Right.
He wants to observe Bilbo, and
because he knows Gandalf has such a high regard. Kate Neville actually points out the fact that we don't really know when that scene takes place, which could be significant. You know, after the dinner, before the light table, after the council. You know, I mean, we don't have a time mark for that particular scene until we get to see it in the extended edition.
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly. And that the biggest way that would impact it, I would think, is that, of course, the other question, if we're thinking about Elrond's motivations, the biggest question is not really what are his motivations as far as Thorin is concerned, but rather as far as Gandalf is concerned. Because if he is thinking, you know, this poor hobbit has been suckered into going on this quest, which I think is a terrible idea, and I'd like to throw this poor guy a lifeline. If he's thinking that, well, that's, you know, an implicit and more than implicit criticism of Gandalf, who's the one who's actually suckered Bilbo into it. So I agree with Kate that it would make a difference. when exactly
it happened. Well, you know, it's also a nice bit of foreshadowing to what's going to happen in The Lord of the Rings, where Bilbo is going to go to Rivendell
and stay
with Elrond.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree.
Yana points out, of course, that it can't be after the council because they leave during the council.
Oh, right, of course.
Just something I was going to say, which is, you know, we do already have sort of this implicit, the fact that Gandalf feels the need to sort of secretly support the dwarves to leave, you know, without Elrond knowing about it, also sort of always implied that there was some, you know,
tension
that
or,
he felt that he needed to,
Well, I mean, even if you think back to the way that, you know, to the sort of the notorious, you know, cranky Elrond scenes in the Fellowship of the Ring, you know, and those kind of snippy conversations that Elrond and Gandalf have,
right.
You know, so that there is, it certainly does exist within these characters and their relationship, as it's been depicted in Jackson's films, precedent for Elrond and Gandalf not really seeing eye to eye and not being, you know, exactly on the same page. So
aligned, yeah.
Yeah. So that does seem to make sense. Brianna points out that Elrond didn't want Merry and Pippin to join the Fellowship either. Yes, in what is clearly one of Hugo Weaving's instances of eyebrow overacting, his eyebrow, and I feel when I'm talking about Hugo Weaving's acting that I really feel compelled, which I never have before, to make up an adjective of the word eyebrow that is like his eyebrovian acting. would that be the adjectival form? Anyway, his eyebrovial expression when Merry and Pippin come running in, is I have to say a little bit over the top. However, as much as I hate to criticize Hugo Weaving's eyebrows, which are clearly among the most talented set of eyebrows I know, so it will be. I mean, it's going to be this. This could be. I mean, it's too bad we're not going to get more Hugo Weaving in this second film, or it really could be. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Eyebrow Hall of Fame. If only Sean Connery were too. But anyway, but now I'm digressing. So anyway, so but the point I'm sure at
and Gandalf is no slouch when it comes to eyebrows.
True. Exactly.
Especially the Gandalf of the book itself.
Exactly, whose eyebrows stick out beyond the brim of his hat.
Beyond the brim of his hat. That's
right. Exactly. One of my own personal life goals. But anyway, but no, we were talking about the sort of the lack of seeing eye to eye between Gandalf and Elrond. But I still do agree with Kate that the placement of it does change something. If this exchange happens very soon after they've arrived, or, you know, does it happen after they've, you know, they've been settled, you know, like after the dinner and, you know, they've been settled in there, you know, it's definitely, is this a first reaction from Elrond, or is this a, you know, I want to catch this guy before they leave? I know they leave by surprise, but still, I mean, you know, he knows they're planning to leave. I would be interested to see where it's placed. Anyway, so I do think that that's an interesting question, but to me, the way that this talks about Elrond's unfamiliar, you know, speaks to his unfamiliarity with hobbits, I do find the idea that Elrond is also just kind of wanting to get to know Bilbo better. Again, even that picks up on stuff from the books. I mean, you know, you think of the line in the Council of Elrond where Elrond says that, you know, he knows little of hobbits and has, you know, has known none other than Bilbo, and that, you know, is now from listening to Frodo beginning to think that perhaps, you know, Bilbo is not quite so singular as he had thought him. Is, you know, it definitely shows both an ignorance and some kind of an awareness of his ignorance of Elrond. So anyway, I think that will be kind of interesting to see. And I would be glad to see more depth in Elrond's character in the extended edition. Because as I say, we did get so little of him in the cinematic release. But boy, I thought that clip was just lovely. I mean, and Yana is absolutely right when he said a little bit earlier on that the application of that, you know, go not to the elves for counsel, for they shall say both no and yes line in this scene is really brilliant and even sensitively done, because of course, you know, in context, what Bilbo is picking up on there is the fact that Elrond has just suggested two different things, right? I have heard that hobbits are very resilient, and I have heard that they like the comforts of home. So, you know, what Bilbo is saying in a very understated way is, so, dude, are you advising me to stay or go? You know, like, do you think my going is a good idea or a bad idea? I can't tell. And that's, I think, very well done. And to not only convey that in an understated way as they do, but to do that through the importation of a Lord of the Rings quote, I think is very, very well done.
Clever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Charity's asking, doesn't Galadriel offer something similar to the Fellowship when they reach Lothlorien? She does sort of as part of her test, doesn't
right.
she?
Right. Right. But see, there it is explicitly a test, you know, that is a test of their resolve as to whether or not they're going to go on. And that really kind of comes back to, you know, Trish, the first thing that you were saying about Elrond and his motivations here, because, of course, you'll remember, you know, Boromir openly questions the motivations of Galadriel when she's doing this. And really, this is something that I think this was a point, actually, I once heard Mike Drought make, and I think that he's very right to do it. And it's something, basically, fans tend to give Galadriel a free pass. Like, of course, you know, Galadriel, she is good and she is wise, and so everything that she does is good. That's not necessarily true. You know, that there's an argument to be made that Galadriel, that basically Boromir's right. Galadriel doesn't really have the right to test them as she is. And that, especially in the way that she does, by basically getting into their heads and, you know, tempting them, as she seems to do, that, you know, one can make the argument that she stepped over a line here, and that it's not, you know, that she's kind of playing God with them, and, you know, she is not the Valar, you know, this is not really her place. I mean, I'm not saying that that's necessary. I mean, that that's necessarily my reading, but I do agree that one can make that case. There is enough to support that. I think even in Galadriel's own words that she sort of recognized, you know, there is some recognition by Tolkien in his many writings on Galadriel, both during and after the time of the publication of The Lord of the Rings, that Galadriel has issues, you know, has issues that she's still sorting through, and her pride and desire to dominate others and to control them, that's one of her issues. So anyway, basically, again, coming back to Elrond then, the parallel.
But wait.
Okay. What?
Because I was actually going to say this, because you talked through this, and I was going to tell the listeners that the free course on iTunes University on Fellowship of the Ring that Corey gave last summer, we talked about this very topic.
Right.
You know, and I just wanted to share that was a real eye-opener for me, you know, this thing about, you know, you're right, Galadriel kind of is stepping across the line. And I wanted to add one more piece to that, and then we can move back to Elrond, is also keep in mind that when she's testing them, she has not had her own test yet.
Right, exactly.
She still is trying to decide whether or not to wrest the ring, or, you know, she's still in her own conflict. And I had never thought of that, because I had done just like you said, you know, oh, Galadriel, she's so wonderful and stuff. So
right.
I just want to recommend it to listeners, iTunes University, if you haven't listened to the course, this is one of the topics we talked about. And I think it's really worth, even if you end up not agreeing, I think it's a great conversation to listen to.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. She hasn't passed the test, and she does pass the test. But yeah, I mean, I do think there's definitely a question there. But then again, with Elrond, you know, if there is some level of test that he's doing, why is he doing it? Especially given the at best thinly veiled animosity between him and Thorin, during that, again, how they're depicted in that first film, that would seem to make the question of his, you know, Elrond's motivations that much more complicated, you know, that much more sort of thorny to kind of work through, because him working against somebody who is working against the quest of the ring is obviously in the wrong, right?
Right.
But somebody who is working against the quest of Thorin Oakenshield, especially say if they consider it a mad quest, doomed to failure and possibly to cause serious troubles, that's not a no-brainer that, you know, that a right-thinking good guy could, you know, possibly take it upon themselves to at least contemplate acting against Thorin, even at this stage. So, Laura, go ahead.
The only thing is, I mean, that's assuming that Elrond thinks that Bilbo is really essential to the quest.
Sure.
At this point, it's pretty questionable how much Bilbo is actually going to contribute to the success. I mean, perhaps he's talked to Gandalf about it, but, you know, just from seeing Bilbo, you wouldn't think that he is going to make or his, you know, presence or absence in the quest is really going to make or break the success of it.
Now, speaking of Bilbo, Sharon makes a really good point. If we turn this clip around and look at it from and watch Bilbo, she makes the point, if she thinks that Bilbo seems way too comfortable in the presence of Elrond, you know, way too cool, way too at ease. And I can kind of see her point there, you know. I mean, he's not really awestruck, you know, which is kind of how I'm kind of left with in the book, is he's sort of awestruck in the book. You know, by the time this, whatever timing this click takes place, it sure looks like Bilbo got pretty comfy with being around the elves.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the one thing that I would, thinking about that depiction in the book, it's true, you know, with the book being told not as a first person account from Bilbo's point of view, but essentially from Bilbo's perspective, or at least sort of following Bilbo's perspective, Elrond is given to us in the book as a distant description. You know, we get that description of him, you know, the very general description of him, which, you know, ends up with him being as kind as summer in the published version, as kind as Christmas, of course, as I always think of from the first draft. But anyway, again, it certainly is a more remote description. You don't get the sense at all that Bilbo and Elrond have become pals, but see there, I would want to see the context too, and exactly.
Yeah, that's true. We're along the lines. Boy, you're right. You know, kind as Christmas. I mean, Hugo Weaving's Elrond definitely does not make me think of Christmas.
No.
Or even really of summer, for that matter.
No, he's pretty frosty, really.
Yeah, I mean, he is.
though, again, that's another thing I think that struck me so much about this clip. Elrond smiles more in that clip than I think he did in the entire Lord of the Rings film. Like all three put together.
Yes.
So yeah.
He seemed almost fatherly in there. Yes. In that clip to me.
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, that seems to me to have a lot to do with Bilbo's. I mean, there are certainly moments there where Bilbo is obviously on edge, you know, like that moment where he, you know, says the thing about saying both no and yes, and then clearly thinks he's like put his foot in it and, you know, and is clearly worried, you know, so you can see him kind of, there's a certain amount of, you know, eggshell walking on his part. So he's not totally blasé about it. But yeah, Pete points out that Elrond wasn't stressing
out about it. Yeah, Pete brings up something I was just going to say. Yeah. It's like, well, Elrond doesn't have to worry about Arwen dating Aragorn, dating someone.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because my first reaction when I saw the first movie, when we saw Elrond, because remember when Elrond comes to the bottom of the stairs and he greets Gandalf and he smiles then? And I remember thinking to myself, ah, we have carefree Elrond in this movie.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'd say.
These aren't bad yet.
No, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, he's like the father whose daughter isn't a teenager yet, except of course she's already several hundred years old, but his daughter's fiance isn't a teenager yet. So I guess that's That's still makes a difference.
You know, I'm still holding out for a view of Estelle in the extended edition as a little boy.
That'd
be cool. That would be really cool.
That really does strike me as the kind of you know, sort of Easter egg that I can totally imagine them.
Yeah.
Yeah, except wouldn't he be 27?
No, he'd be like 8 or 12 or I'm forgetting the analogy now. But it's young. I mean, it's he'd be like juvenile to adolescent Aragorn.
Okay.
I think if I'm remembering that correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm forgetting my 9. Okay, yeah. I thought it was. Yeah.
60 years previously and Aragorn is 87. In the
right, and it's 77. Yeah, he's like 9'10". That's right, 9'10".
I'm talking about the movie.
Oh,
right. He'd be 27, wouldn't he?
Oh,
that's right. You're right, of course.
That's right, because they compress the time. I forgot about that.
In the weird,
We'll have to look for a young man and not a kid.
Yes, because the. We do get the 60 years.
We don't have the 17-year gap between party.
You know, from the beginning, we've been... I mean, this is, of course, one of the questions that people have been talking about since years before the first film came out. You know, will we get a Viggo Mortensen cameo in Rivendell? And all of the book nerds have all been, you know, we've all been, you know... cheerfully pouring cold water on this idea by saying, no, that's not possible. Aragorn would only be 10. But of course, Laura, you're exactly right. Since we did not get a 17-year gap between the unexpected, between the long expected party and, you know, Frodo's departure from the Shire, then it is only 60 total years. And Aragorn says he's what, 90 something. He should be in his 30s at this point, right?
Well, he's 87 in the movie because he says that.
Is that what he says to Eowyn?
Eowyn, yes, yeah. 87, yeah. So
Kay makes the point of we might see a 20-year-old arriving back at Rivendell after being out with Elrond's sons, you know, riding in back into Rivendell from having been out.
No, my goodness, yeah. No, that's totally within the alternate time universe of the Peter Jackson films.
That's right. That's right.
Totally possible. Yeah.
Alternate reality. First look of maybe, love.
And maybe he'll be carrying the doll. doll.
Who knows?
Okay. All right.
So anyway, okay. So, let's see. We've got. I think we should probably move on to actually talking about.
Probably move on to the dragon. Right?
Yeah, we should move on to the dragons. Okay. My first question is: I want to talk in general terms about the characterization of Smaug, and let me tell you what I mean by his characterization. I mean, how is his personality going to be manifested? You know, we have because a lot of it. Doesn't even have to be what lines they give to him. A lot of it is in the delivery too. I'm going to play another video clip here. It is time for a little Rankin Bass.
Oh God.
Oh yeah.
Peter Boone. Lights.
The headlight eyes that we alluded to in the trailer there.
I smell you, feel your air, and I hear your breath. Come along. Help yourself. There's plenty and to spare.
Oh, thank you. Oh, Smug, the magnificent.
So you listen to, hang on a second, realizing why this is so quiet.
I have a look at you, see if you are truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them.
Do you now?
They fall utterly short of reality. Oh, Smug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities.
You have knight's manners for a thief and a liar.
Oh, I can't. Okay. All right. I pledged I was going to let it play till I couldn't stand it any longer. And I'm there.
Well, I have to admit to an urge to sing, "Have Gun Will Travel Reads the Card of a Man."
Oh, man.
And Brianna said, "The smug sounds like a drunk hanging outside a bar."
He does. He sounds like a drunken thug. And the thing is, he's delivering lines which are straight from the book. It's not like they've completely messed up the dialogue, but the way that these are delivered, Smaug in the book is sophisticated, urbane, understated, manipulative. I mean, those lines that he gives, "Well, thief, I smell you and feel your air. I hear your breath. Come along, help yourself again. There is plenty and to spare." That there is sarcasm there. You know, there is wit there. This is not like "there's plenty and to spare." You know, I can't stand the delivery of that line, and especially with the contrast that the Rankin Bass film does, where Bilbo is the one who sounds like totally with it and sophisticated, like he's the one intellectually running circles around Smaug, which is just really inappropriate. You know, "You have nice manners for a thief and a liar, ha ha ha." You know, I mean, there's this, you know, I am tracking with you. I totally see through what you're doing. And I'm going to like respond with witty repartee to your obvious flattery. I mean, this is what we get from Smaug. This is, of course, right after, you know, the "truly songs and tales fall utterly short of the reality, O Smaug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities." Even the, like, "you seem familiar with my name, but I don't seem to remember smelling you before. Who are you and where do you come from, may I ask?" You know, the sort of the false politeness that he's doing, which has this sort of implied insult because of the sort of the obvious inequality between them, and the way that he is kind of putting on this show of just being, you know, the polite gentleman receiving a gentleman caller. I mean, again, this is how Smaug carries on, you know? And so again, I think of the Rankin Bass depiction of Smaug, again, his personality, his character. This is like my worst case scenario. And I'm glad.
I don't think we have to worry about
that. I don't think so either.
I have a feeling Cumberbatch is going to, he's going to just hit it out of the park. I mean, he's going to be
very urbane.
Like Yana says, you know, he was such a great villain in the Star Trek movie, you know, that if he's even a tenth of that, you know, I mean, I think he's going to be really good. The thing I'm not really happy about so far, I mean, I can't see Cumberbatch with the dragon we've seen from the trailer. Remember we talked about it when we watched the trailer, that it seemed like it was a bumpy dragon that looked like one of those lantern fish.
Right, exactly. But at least he doesn't have fur for some reason.
This is true.
Yeah,
this
is true. That?
I've never understood the whiskers and the fur all down the back. What the heck? Dragon, it is not a mammal. I'm sorry. It is not a mammal.
Well, some of the animation choices in this movie are just a little scary.
Yes. Yes, they are. But anyway, okay. So again, how do you do Smaug? So again, the trick here, though, one of the things that I think is really difficult is that I think that there is a real challenge that is put in the way of this, just the fact that this is in a visual medium, and it's going to be much, much harder for Peter Jackson to do it well, even than for Rankin Bass. It's easier in a cartoon. I mean, if you just looking mercifully, I will not play the audio again, but if you just look at the scenes here, you know, we've got this shot of Smaug here, okay, in the super close-up, and the shot of Bilbo, that, you know, we can just show these wide shots and we don't have the two of them in the same shot at any time. We just go back and forth between Bilbo and Smaug. So in other words, you can create the visual sense in which we have two people just talking with each other. If we have a live action scene with the full-sized Smaug talking to Bilbo, to a little Bilbo, the size discrepancy makes a huge difference. And the same line delivered in the same way between two people who are approximately on the same physical level and between one who is this giant, enormous, hugely scary looking thing and a tiny little hobbit, it makes a really big difference. So even sort of the suavity of Smaug is something that I think is going to be harder to pull off when we're looking at a huge dragon saying these things. We're imagining a huge dragon saying it in the book, but that's different. It's, you know, we are not, we don't have, I mean, like, I'm thinking of that shot in the trailer of, you know, Smaug's head towering all, you know, by itself over Bilbo. And imagining that mouth, which is right next to Bilbo and many times larger than his entire body, uttering some of these suave, understated, sarcastic comments, it's a little hard to imagine. Do you see what I mean by this?
Yeah. I think, though, that if they, you know, they don't shoot it with the entire dragon in the scene, but just have his head talking to Bilbo,
that
it won't be quite so. It won't quite ruin that. That, you know, that there. It's almost like they're playing. I don't know what the sports analogy is, but you know, in their conversation, they're kind of hitting the ball back and forth.
Right.
And
right.
If you see a giant dragon doing this with a tiny little hobbit, yeah, it's going to kind of ruin that. But if they just have his head in the shot, then I don't think it'll be quite that bad.
But see, I think
we'll see what they come up with.
I think it's quite possible that.
Now I wonder if the dragon is going to have eyebrows. He's going to have some eyebrow action on the dragon.
Well, he does have eyebrow ridges. He may not have actual eyebrows.
Exactly. Well, I am hoping that they actually can, because see, there are ways in which the size discrepancy really can play into making it even more interesting, I think. Because again, it's part of Smaug's thing, right? You know, I'm going to play the fake, I'm going to pretend to be polite, right? I mean, in, you know, normally, and we see this, you know, there are jokes made about this in The Hobbit. I mean, in my book, I talked a little bit about the theme of politeness and rudeness and how people like Bjorn, who are bigger and stronger than almost everybody round about and aren't really afraid of anybody else, can afford to be rude. But people who are not can't afford to be rude. So if you're only the size of a hobbit, you should not be rude to an eagle while, you know, up in its eyrie at night. Nor certainly should you be rude to Bjorn, nor obviously should you laugh at live dragons either. Smaug, of course, is certainly on the far end of this spectrum. He has no reason, he has no necessity to be polite, and he certainly has little, there would be little expectation that he would be polite to the thief who has broken into his hoard, and who, of course, has already been the occasion of him you know, roaring out of his mountain and, you know, crashing up and down the hillside, as he does when he discovers that the cup is missing. So again, part of what makes the scene really fun and amusing in the book is the departure from expectations. When it turns out, when Bilbo goes down the second time and finds out that Smaug is awake and aware of him, the immediate expectation of, I think, of the, you know, the uninformed reader, that is the reader not reading the book for the 50th time, and of Bilbo himself, is that Smaug is just going to react in rage. And instead, he, you know, ushers him in with urbane and would-be polite conversation. And again, that's part of Smaug's thing, that he, one who has no reason to be manipulative, who has no need to be, you know, understated and underhanded and subtle, is nevertheless all of those things, and chooses to deceive and manipulate rather than just smash, though he does smash also. So I think that there are ways in which the film could actually really play on the discrepancy of the kind of urbanity of Smaug's conversation, given the sort of, disproportionate, ridiculous lack of necessity for him to act like that. So that could be really cool. But at the same time, I can also imagine it looking really strange and Smaug sounding really supercilious. Yeah. Supercilious, not in the eyebrow sense. Several people were pointing out that supercilious literally, like the word in Latin refers to eyebrows. So the adjective supercilious could be suborned to be of a referring to eyebrows.
Goodness.
I kind of like that idea, though the problem with that is that no one outside of the 36 people in this broadcast at this point would have the faintest idea that that's what you meant by the word supercilious when you said if you referred to Hugo Weaving's supercilious acting, they would think you were just insulting him. But anyway.
Now, Pete makes the point of saying, like in the book, and I'm hoping we see a little bit of this, if nothing else, that Smaug is having the conversation with Bilbo. I think the narrator actually tells us that Smaug is kind of having the conversation with Bilbo because he's trying to suss him out. He's trying to figure out what he is, who he is. I mean, he's got an agenda in the conversation. And then the other thing is, who is somebody just said, Chris mentioned, and I know I had a conversation with you about this before we were on air, Corey, is I believe even though we see Bilbo in the trailer, that doesn't necessarily mean that Bilbo's going to be visible to Smaug. I mean, I think there still is a question as to whether Bilbo's going to be visible or invisible to Smaug on his visits.
Right. And this is the one that is also the one kind of proviso that I would add or that I would kind of a proviso I would have to add the stuff I was saying about how Smaug obviously has no need to be polite to anybody because he's not afraid of anybody. There is one possible doubt involved here, which is Bilbo is a species of creature Smaug has never encountered before. You know, he smells unlike anything Smaug has known. So he is an unknown variable to Smaug. And obviously, he is a magical creature, because he is invisible right now. And Smaug has no idea by what mechanism he is making himself invisible. And you'll notice that Bilbo plays up to this. In Bilbo's riddling, identity thing, he attempts to depict himself as a creature of mystery and mysterious power. That he sort of implies that he not only has the power to turn himself invisible, but also that he can fly and that he has all of these powerful allies, the bears and the eagles, and all these other things. So he is the knower of mysteries and all this stuff. So his titles mostly sound pretty impressive. And even the ones which Smaug passes off as not sounding nearly so creditable, that is like the one who buries his friends alive, buries his friends and draws them alive again afterwards. Again, this is still like, I am the mystery. I am the miracle worker. And there may well be in Smaug's mind just the question of, is there, could this be true? Who and what is this guy? He might actually have more power, because this could be a wizard. This could be Gandalf or somebody like him. It is possible. You think about that conversation that Gandalf and the dwarves have in Bag End in the film about how many dragons Gandalf has killed, right? I mean, there is that precedent for wizards as dragon killers, which, as I think I've said before, there's precedent for, in the first drafts of chapter one of The Hobbit, Gandalf is said to have turned dragons inside out before, that he is a an accomplished vanquisher of dragons in his career. So, you know, maybe in the book we are supposed to be thinking that there is at least that little element or potential element of doubt on Smaug's part that he's actually trying to figure out. Though at the same time, it also seems to be vanity, you know, that it doesn't really have any doubt that he can handle this intruder. And he is pretty convinced that he's going to smash them. And this is just a preamble to smashing them anyway. And in reality, he just wants to kind of satisfy his own personal curiosity before he smashes them, because, you know, he's just kind of curious and he wants his question answered by this creature before he destroys him. So anyway, I do think that you know, there is that element, and I would be interested to see if they play that up. Now, the thing is, having Smaug glimpse Bilbo visible undermines that. If he's seen Bilbo, he's unlikely to be afraid of him even after he turns invisible, I would think. So it would be harder to see them, unless, again, this, you know, kind of gets back to what we were saying about the Elrond clip. The shot that we saw in the trailer of Smaug seeing him, if we do run with the assumption that Bilbo is in fact going to be invisible during the conversation with Smaug, does that face-to-face that we see in the trailer happen before or after? I think theoretically it could be either.
Oh my gosh, Chris Lawson just said he has to go because there's earthquake. Chris is in New Zealand.
An earthquake in New Zealand? Oh, I hope it's not too bad.
Me too.
Goodness. We have never had a natural disaster happen in the midst of a broadcast before.
No, and we don't want to start now.
No, we don't want to start now. Yeah.
We don't.
A couple of the listeners are comparing Glaurung, you know, Glaurung Tur and Glaurung Nienor to Bilbo Smaug conversation. Like Tom is saying that it would be interesting to compare the two and see what they tell us about dragons, especially from Tolkien's point of view. I mean, there is a lot of difference. I mean, Glaurung actually had a specific mission. I mean, it was really kind of different, isn't it? I mean, contextually, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, anyway.
I agree.
Well, I have no ending to that sentence.
It is, but Glaurung is calculating, just like Smaug is.
Exactly.
That cunning nature.
I totally agree, Laura. That's what I was going to say too. That there is that similarity of the devious mind. Both of them show that kind of deviousness. Dragons are associated in Tolkien's world with cunning, not just with greed, but with cunning. And although they do have very great power, you know, both just their pure physical strength and their breathing fire and all that stuff. It's the deviousness and cunning of their minds, which is one of the most dangerous things about them. We see even the kinds of spells that Glaurung casts, that is how he induces amnesia in Nienor and how he sort of paralyzes Turin and deceives Turin in the way that he does. All of those things still seem to be really expressions of the power of his mind. He looks Nienor full in the eyes and she looks him full in the eyes, and his mind just overwhelms hers. Not quite to the point of just snuffing it out, but close to that. He just overloads her. And you know, they have a little battle of minds, kind of like the battles that we see Aragorn having with Sauron, Gandalf having with Sauron, Gandalf sort of struggling to deflect Sauron's mind from discovering Frodo upon Amon Hen, Gandalf and Saruman. We see lots of different examples of those kinds of, you know, conflicts of wills and conflicts of minds in Tolkien's world. Glaurung is really good at it. And Smaug does the same thing too. That, of course, in the more juvenile language of The Hobbit, is what the narrator means when he says that Smaug had a rather overwhelming personality. You know, that's a sort of a comical understatement. Glaurung had a pretty darn overwhelming personality too, and completely overwhelmed both Nienor and Turin with it at various points.
Now, wasn't Wasn't Glaurung kind of also invested directly with some of Morgoth's power?
Yeah, I mean,
I always got that impression. There was some of Morgoth was sort of, you know, empowering him directly.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, that's true. Well, sort of. It's hard to say. I mean, the passage in the Silmarillion about the dragons and the, you know, sort of the, because of course Glaurung was the prototype, and so the presumably the things that it says about the creation of the dragons would apply to him. The evils, you know, and the reference to things like, you know, that then he spoke the first time Glaurung ever speaks. It says in the Silmarillion, then he spoke by the evil spirit that was within him. And it's a little hard to know exactly how to take that. That is,
right.
It is his spirit in him, which is evil, that permits him to speak. Or is there some external evil spirit operating within him, which permits him to speak? And is that even conceivably in some sense Morgoth's spirit acting within him? Mm-hmm. That, you know, what I can imagine somebody taking that line that way, and I don't really think that that's right, but I don't think I could totally disprove it definitively, because there we do get those clear references to Morgoth kind of dispersing his own will and his own personality among his servants. So anyway, that's kind of a complicated question. And Smaug, obviously, we don't have that factor directly involved, obviously, but we do get that same, kind of going back to the similarities, we do get that same tendency in Smaug as in Glaurung to dominate and manipulate first and smash afterwards. So anyway, and that is, again, coming back to then the question of how this is going to be done in the films. To what extent are we going to get that? Are we going to get any kind of, you know, semi-hypnotic effect? Are we going to, I mean, Martin Freeman is so good, you know, as we were saying earlier, with his facial acting, are we going to get from Martin Freeman any kind of like, I am being put in a trance, I am being, you know, I am at risk of, you know, being drawn in, you know, by Smaug? Is that element going to be involved? Or are we just going to get banter from the two of them? Because in the book, again, it's not just banter. Bilbo is trying to deflect Smaug, and Smaug is trying to manipulate and ultimately to pervert and dominate Bilbo. That's what's going on in that conversation. To what extent are we going to get those kinds of things going on in the film? Or are we just going to get repartee, simply?
You know, Gabriel brings up a point which also I wanted to talk about, too. It'll be interesting to see if the Turin dream shows up.
Boy. Yeah, I would love it. I would love it.
Didn't because I would
like that to be the opening sequence of the film. Didn't I say that?
I think you did. Yeah.
If not, let me say it again. That would rule. That would absolutely rule. If the first scene of this film were a fight with Smaug, which ended with Smaug being stabbed and killed, and then Smaug wakes up from the dream, man, I can't even tell you how happy that would make me. I don't think it's going
to
happen.
That would be a great way to do it. Yeah.
Boy, that would be awesome.
I've got a question about dragons. Somebody asked me this earlier. Which dragon was considered the greatest dragon? Was it Glaurung? Was it Encalagon?
Yeah, I mean, there are really only three candidates.
No, it's not Smaug. I mean,
yeah, well, I guess four. In that, you know, I mean, think of the number of named dragons that we know of are quite few. And in fact,
there's
four, right? Skava the worm, yeah, the one that the one that Graham kills. And is that it? I can't think of a fifth named dragon. I mean, obviously, you know, in other books, but not in Middle Earth.
I was going to say, if you can extend Middle Earth to, you know, it was this world, we have Chrysophylax. And yeah, I had to say that just simply because I like to say Chrysophylax.
Right, exactly. Right. Or the Great White Dragon from Rover Random. But no,
right.
No, thinking only of thinking only of Middle-earth dragons. You know, the way that Gandalf throws out the name of Enkhaoagan the Black certainly suggests that he is the tops. You know, Gandalf throws out his name to say, not even Enkhaoagan the Black could melt the ring. So he's clearly bringing him up in a superlative context, given that Gandalf is looking back at historical first age dragons, as Enkhaoagan was the dragon killed by Eärendil during the final, you know, the closing scenes of the War of Wrath. Presumably Enkhaoagan is greater than Glaurung, or else Gandalf would have said Glaurung in making that claim. So then the only question would be, is Smaug greater than Enkhaoagan? And I gotta say no. I think that Smaug is, he's kind of a big deal, yeah. Kind of self-delusional too. I mean, that's part of the irony of chapter 12 of The Hobbit, you know, is that Bilbo is... There is, of course, a very real sense in which Bilbo gets the better of Smaug in the conversation because he sees through him. You know, that line that Bilbo delivers to himself, not to Smaug, you know, old fool, you know, when he sees the bear patch in his armor, Smaug is undermined in the middle of his great boast. Boasting about how invulnerable he is, his vulnerability is revealed. So I think Smaug is clearly not greater than Enkhaoagan. So I think based on the evidence we'd have to go with Enkhaoagan. But anyway.
Yeah, that's who I would have thought too.
Yeah, probably. So. But anyway.
Now I gotta say that I'm really looking forward to Martin Freeman's delivery of his, you know, string of names.
Yeah.
And I really hope Jackson leaves. He may not leave it completely intact. Like, he may take Clue Finder out because he figures people won't know what that is. But I really, he's got to keep at least 80% of that in.
Yeah, it will be interesting. And especially, you know, it kind of leads me to a sort of a more general Bilbo point, thinking towards film two. I'll just be really interested to see if Martin Freeman does Bilbo significantly less bumbling. You know, that kind of stammering, I'm totally unsure of myself and feeling really self-conscious thing that Martin Freeman does with Bilbo so often. Is that going to be reduced? Is that going to go away?
Well, you'd have to think so, because they're saying this is going to be a lot more serious, more a darker movie than the first one. So that kind of acting, I think, would be played down a little bit. And Bilbo also is more—he's proven himself more from the first film. He's
right.
More of the hero, so he can't really be so bumbling.
And of course, that's one of the things about this scene in the book, is that Bilbo. This is the one moment in the book when Bilbo gets too tookish. You know, it's really the only time when his tookishness exceeds his Bagginsishness, and that is when he is overconfident. He is flippant. He believes that he can handle Smaug. So that's what I'm going to be really interested to see, if Martin Freeman is going to do any of that element of Bilbo just thinks he is too much for Smaug, and that he can easily twist Smaug around. And, you know, this is what Bilbo chides himself for, you know, never laugh at live dragons, Bilbo, you fool. He realizes that he was dumb. He realizes that he was overconfident. But it's hard to see Martin Freeman's Bilbo being overconfident, especially confronted with Smaug.
I hope they do. I hope they do leave that in there.
Yeah.
It would add a little complexity to Bilbo.
Yeah. Yeah, Daniel makes an interesting point about Smaug. He says, Yeah, Daniel was pointing out that he really likes Rob Inglis's Smaug voice in the audio recording, the audiobook recording, because it shows how Smaug cannot hide the true beast despite his mannerism and attempt to have a smoothing, tempting voice. The beast is always present. And that's, I mean, that's Tolkien makes that point about dragons, you know, that they are, you know, they are highly intelligent. They are, you know, they have this overwhelming personality, but all, they do remain beasts as well. And that's one of the things that's really scary about them. So I agree, Daniel, I think that that's a really interesting element of the characterization that, that again, it will be interesting to see. Because again, that's, it's one of the things that I would worry about. If we get a visually really striking dragon, I can easily imagine a huge, scary-looking dragon on screen with a human voice coming out of him, and even if it's Cumberbatch's voice, it just seeming not to fit. You know, the voice did not fit with what we're looking at. And again, I'm assuming they won't have that problem, but certainly it's a challenge that they have to overcome carefully.
Chris Lawson just piped up and said that it was a 6.2 quake.
Ooh.
And he's okay, but they're being sent home.
Oh, so yeah.
He's going to have to hear the rest of this later.
Yeah. Well, Chris, we're glad, you're okay.
Wow.
6.2, that's not a joke.
Wow.
Yes. Oh, and Yana was reminding me earlier that, of course, I did broadcast in the middle of a hurricane once, so I guess I can't say there was no natural disaster. But,
oh, that's right. That's right. That. Assume we forget.
That one you knew about.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That was me, though. I mean, that's, you know, whatever. Yeah. Well, yeah, certainly. Thoughts and prayers for Chris and everybody in New Zealand, that everybody's okay over there.
Boy, you know, Brianna was saying that Cumberbatch is a villain in another piece, too. And, you know, he seems to be really good at this villain stuff.
Yeah, well.
He's a double villain in The Hobbit, you know, both Sauron and Smaug. I mean, the guy's kind of going to get typecast.
Well, and this is one of the things that I find so fascinating is just thinking of, I mean, as Dave and I talked about long, long ago, I mean, I still have to assume that at least in their initial conception, maybe they've changed it. Maybe they're going to pull a Bolg on this one and change their minds. But clearly in their initial conception, they had lines for Sauron. They wouldn't have cast somebody as Sauron if they didn't. So certainly not Cumberbatch. So what are Smaug's lines going to be like? And how similar or different are they going to be from Smaug's lines? I mean, you know, we get those two, the Smaug and Sauron connection. And of course, making a connection between them seems appropriate, you know, would seem interesting. But anyway, so yeah, I think that that's certainly Cumberbatch in general is one of the things I am very excited about for this film. And I, you know, Sharon asks if they're going to alter his voice somehow. You know, I assume there will probably be some effects, but at the same time, with only a few exceptions, they seem to have been reluctant to do that. They seem to let the actors just kind of handle it, you know? I mean, I think of like they're the audio effects that they did on, you know, Galadriel when she does her, you know, in place of the Dark Lord, you shall have a queen, you know? Like, you know, and they do like the, you know, reverb effects and stuff on her voice there. But I'm trying to think of, you know, other places where they have actors cast, especially well-known actors cast, and have their voices, you know, altered throughout, you know, just as a staple part of them delivering lines. I don't think they did that anywhere.
Well, now they had, I mean, Treebeard was John Rhys-Davies, but that wasn't very... I mean, that he wasn't in the movie that long. I mean, like you're talking about, like for the whole length of a movie, right?
Right. But even there, I mean, was his voice wasn't digitally
was it modified? I don't seem like so. It was different enough. Well, yeah, maybe not. Maybe he just.
I think it's him doing the voice.
He just modified it himself.
Yeah, well, three of you have said this at once. Was his voice modified? Sharon says it was. Okay.
Mm.
Okay. But see there. Well, so maybe we have then a precedent for one of them being and not the other. My guess though is that they did that because it was. Because they didn't want it to sound like they're talking to Gimli.
Yeah. they didn't want us to catch on that they were saving money by having.
Right, exactly. So, you know, maybe you modify one and not the other, in which case, which one? I would guess it would be Sauron. But
yeah, the one with the fewer lines.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the other thing that actually I hope does not happen that you just made me think of when you were talking about Smaug and Sauron, I hope they don't make a connection between the two, you know, along the lines of what I was earlier positing with Morgoth and Glaurung.
Right.
I mean, I really hope he doesn't do that, that there's any kind of inference that there's a connection between, you know, what I'm actually thinking of is like with Théoden and Saruman speaking through Théoden in the movie. Remember how Jackson did that? I mean, I hope they don't do something like that.
No. Wow, that would be dreadful.
Wouldn't that be awful?
And that prospect never even occurred to me. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, idea. You cannot now unsee it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Yeah, and then like Gandalf comes in and does an exorcism of Smaug, and they're like, great, we've got the necromancer. Oh, wait, crap, we've still got this huge lizard on our hands. It didn't help.
And he's pissed.
Right, exactly.
I could see that though, because maybe they're doing a little riff on the Morgoth Glaurung thing, you know, to have a little bit of Sauron in this dragon's smile.
A little bit of Sauron. Sorry.
Well, see, but the thing is for there to be some kind of connection between them, that is in the sense of some kind of correspondence between them would not be inappropriate at all. I mean, that's exactly what Gandalf in The Quest of Erebor says that he was afraid of, you know, that he considered an alliance between Sauron and Smaug, you know, very natural and possibly inevitable. Depending on where they're going with the necromancer in these films, depending on how fully developed they're going to do Sauron's character in these films, it could entirely work to have Sauron sending an emissary to Smaug saying, hey, so I got a job for you. Do you feel like smashing Rivendell? Does that sound like fun? Can we collaborate on this? And then, you know, maybe, the destruction of Smaug over, over Lake Town happens like in the nick of time that we see a plan beginning to unfold. And we could basically see dramatized in the film what Gandalf says in Appendix A. The fact that, you know, the two of them would have worked together, but that was prevented thanks to the quest by, you know, thanks to his meeting with Thorin, basically thanks to the fact that Thorin and company went on this mission. We could actually see that dramatized.
You just got your revenge on me. Oh yeah, Smaug on the way to destroy Rivendell got offed in Lake Town.
Right. Well, not necessarily en route. Like, hang on, I've just got one errand to run, and then I'm off to Rivendell.
maybe they'll discuss that when they're on their return visit in the third movie. Maybe by that time they will have discovered that the necromancer was Sauron, and they'll talk about that. Oh, it's a good thing that Smaug was taken care of.
Actually, I more than half expect that. I more than half expect some kind of equivalent of, not equivalent, but I would expect lines to be lifted from that speech of Gandalf's in Appendix A, that thing which was or was going to be the the end of the Quest of Erebor. But fortunately, that's all been prevented thanks to this. I suspect that's going to make its way in, that Gandalf is going to do some kind of retrospective. Now that we've kicked the necromancer out of Mirkwood and discovered who he was and killed Smaug, looking at it now, whew, boy, that could have been ugly. You know, this
close one.
I'm sure we're going to be grateful later on that we did this, you know, or that this. So, yeah, I mean, I do. Obviously, it's not going to be able to be given from the full point of view of hindsight that we get, you know, at the end of the Quest of Erebor, at the end of, you know, in Appendix A. But I do think they're probably going to go there. So, yeah, to what extent that's going to be involved in the plot, if we're going to get any kind of communication or attempt at communication. Again, I'm not saying it would necessarily make for a great film, but it would be plausible within the parameters that that Tolkien lays out for what is going on, or, you know, would have been going on behind the scenes.
I'm just thinking, I just see Jeremy asking some questions here, and I'm just thinking that some of the folks listening might not be up on the Quest of Erebor.
Yeah.
So you might want to maybe explain that.
Yeah, just a quick reminder about it. The Quest of Erebor is, of course, if you've read the appendices and you remember at the end of Appendix A, that is the end of the section on the dwarves, when we get that retrospective scene of Gandalf and Gimli and Frodo and some others sitting around in Minas Tirith afterwards and talking about, you know, looking back on the quest, and Gandalf making those comments about it's a good thing that, you know, Smaug was killed, or else the War of the Ring would have turned out very differently. Well, those comments were originally, Tolkien originally wrote a very much longer, or planned at least, a very much longer appendix than that. And he had them asking him, Gimli and Frodo, asking him to tell them the full, his version of the full story of how the whole thing came about. How did he alight on Bilbo, and how did he end up getting connected with Thorin, and what's Gandalf's whole perspective on it? That was ended up being cut from the appendices. Christopher Tolkien published it in Unfinished Tales under the title The Quest of Erebor. So when I'm talking about that retrospective point of view, I mean from a chronologically post War of the Ring point of view, looking back on the whole story. And that's what we're given in The Quest of Erebor. And of course, there are many reinterpretations of the story that are invited by Gandalf's point of view as Tolkien articulates it in The Quest of Erebor, written obviously much later than The Hobbit. Many of those things on which I think Peter Jackson is obviously drawing for his depiction. So anyway, and of course he can use that line. He can't use some other lines from The Quest of Erebor, but he can use lines that are in Appendix A because it's in The Lord of the Rings. So
that's right.
That could work.
And so, yeah, so according to the Quest of Erebor, then Gandalf was aware that Sauron was rising again and that he was concerned that he would enlist Smaug. And so Gandalf claimed that part of his own purpose in fostering the quest was to try to do away with this threat of this dragon, right?
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So, I do think... Basically, I don't think that
in the movie he doesn't know that he's Sauron. So that...
Well, he doesn't know yet that he's Sauron. Though again, presumably, the discovery that the necromancer is really Sauron is going to be one of the things that's happening in the films. This is what we've been expecting, and I think, I mean, it has to be. You know, given that we have in film one them talking about this necromancer in Mirkwood and having no idea who he is or what he's doing. We have to get from there to setting up for the War of the Ring and Sauron openly declaring himself before the War of the Ring. So clearly, that discovery is going to be made. But then once he makes it, I would expect him then to make the further connection. Yeah. Wow. In retrospect, given that that necromancer was really Sauron and all, you know, I think we really dodged a bullet here, people, you know, with the death of the dragon. Holy cow. That could have been bad. So I would predict that we'll hear something like that in film three. I think there's going to be too much to do, certainly in film two, to be doing any kind of an elaborate, you know, conspiracy between Sauron and Smaug subplot. I just think it's going to be too much. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Gabriel just said exactly the thing that was on my mind. We're an hour and a half into the episode. We should probably get to the riddle at some point.
Gabriel, you must be new here.
True. Right. True.
Just kidding. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We should totally get to it. Okay, so here...
We have a fair amount of setting up of the riddle.
That's true. So we should definitely get to the general subject of the riddle. And the general subject of the riddle is on how they're going to do Bilbo's... How they're going to set up Bilbo's encounters with the dragon. That is, in particular, how are they going to do Bilbo's encounter with the Horde? I'll tell you in advance our specific question. The question for our riddle this week is, how many times is Bilbo going to enter the Horde of Thror in film 2? Now, you remember in the book, Bilbo goes down... And goes down to the Horde on three separate occasions. He goes down the first time after the secret door opens. Smaug is sound asleep, having his dream, and Bilbo steals the cup and comes up after his departure. After Bilbo's departure, Smaug wakes up, gets really mad, flies around and makes a lot of noise, and then settles down again. Bilbo goes down the second time. They have their conversation. Smaug tries to fry Bilbo and only barely fails, and then sneaks out and smashes the side of the hill. Then Bilbo goes down to the Horde the third time in the company of the dwarves after Smaug's death, though they don't yet know that Smaug is dead. So that's just a little reminder recap of how this happens in the book. So the question is, how are they going to do these things in the film? How many times is Bilbo going to go down there? Our options, I guess I might as well tell you our options since they're not complicated.
But I want to add one thing in there is our question has to do with by way of the secret door. So how many times will Bilbo go into the Horde by way of the secret door?
By way of the secret door.
One of our answers could, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. By way of the secret door. How many times will he descend to the Horde by way of the secret door in film 2? And the... So the options would be A, the book answer is 3 total, B, 2, C, 1, D, more than 3. D would mean basically Bilbo sets up like a commuter line down there, and, you know, like gets a timeshare at Thror's Horde and visits on weekends for a couple months.
Tramp.
I can't even imagine. This is what I mean. I will say, without dissimulation, I can't imagine D being true.
D is strictly our rounding out the list answer.
Yes, right. We have our theoretical possibilities covered. But in all fairness. At least one such answer, which we only included for the sake of thoroughness, turned out to be correct in film 1. So,
true.
You know, Yana says he's starting to take the treasure one by one, right? Exactly. He starts on the shuttle trips with the treasure. Well, the thing is, that happens in the earlier drafts. Tolkien was already reducing the trips down in the first draft of The Hobbit. I'm talking the not the earlier editions, the earlier published editions, in the unpublished drafts of The Hobbit. He originally went down like 3 times. Like, he went down and stole a cup, then he went down again and stole something else, and then he went down the third time and had the conversation, and then they went down again. And there was a scenario in his notes when he was thinking it through that they actually were going to steal a couple loads of gold and be trying to bury it on the mountainside and everything. And then eventually he did away with these. So in Tolkien's own revision process of this scene, he was systematically reducing the number of trips because they just sort of seemed to be redundant. I mean, there was no additional purpose for them. Whereas clearly the two different solo trips that Bilbo makes, play very different roles and have different purposes. So there's a clear reason to have those still remain separate, but that's not to say that a filmmaker who is more compressed for space, might not decide to compress them further and have a total of two. So basically those would be the options. Are we going to see the three? Of course, one of the sort of side points to this is, do we think he's going to steal a cup? Is he going to steal the golden cup? Are we going to get the Beowulf moment in the film or not? What do you guys think? Do you guys think we're going to get the Beowulf moment?
I tend to think not. What do you think, Laura?
I think we will.
You do?
I think we will. Well, yeah, because there'll be a riot in the theater.
No gold cup is stolen.
And I will say that last year, one of the reasons I scored so low was because I didn't have faith that Jackson would do stuff according to the book. So you're probably right.
I think the cup will stay in. It's not a hard thing to leave in. So yeah, I think he'll definitely. And he'll need something to show the dwarves, too.
Well, unless... okay, here's one possible scenario. One possible scenario is he goes down. Peter Jackson rolls together visit one and visit two from the book. So he goes down to explore. Smaug is not asleep. Smaug is asleep and wakes up while he's down there. They have their conversation, and he doesn't have that moment where he comes back and shows something to the dwarves. Instead, he runs back up to the dwarves and says, "Everybody run, the dragon is coming," and then follows an action sequence. That I could easily see happening in the film. So he doesn't, I mean, as Sharon says, he can't show them the Arkenstone. That's true, but he can, but again, I don't think he has to necessarily show them anything. He can just tell them, "Everybody run, here comes the dragon." And that could conceivably be enough to move along with, and to motivate them. So, Kate says maybe.
Yeah, I think, I tend to agree that, I guess I'll give my answer. I think there's just going to be one trip. I think they're going to compress the cup trip and the conversation trip into one. But I do think he is going to, maybe we'll make that our conundrum is this week, is the, will the cup show up or not? But I think he will have something to bring back to show the dwarves, something that the dwarves can look at while they're huddling in their, in the cave.
You know, yeah, maybe. Well, okay, first of all, let me say that I am not assuming that the sequence of the dwarves and Bilbo entering the mountain together is necessarily going to work out like it is in the book. I think it's entirely possible that's just going to happen differently. I could imagine, for instance, the dwarves not going underground into the mountain, but being, you know, even scattered, some of them on top of the mountain, some around them, you know, them coming around and taking refuge elsewhere, and some of them coming in by the front gates. You know, I'm assuming basically what one of the things that informs my reluctance to assume that the book narrative is going to be followed closely there is the fact that the scene of Smaug attacking and the dwarves running away and taking refuge in the mountain, the scene as it's depicted in the book would not be a very satisfying action sequence in a movie, I don't think, at least not on the scale of the action sequences that we got in the first Hobbit film. It fits the dwarves in the book. That is all they can do, because all they're qualified to do in the book is run away. And they run away successfully. You know, but the dwarves in the movie are not so big into running away. And it's a little, you know, I'm wondering if we're going to get any combat, any attempt to actually fight Smaug, rather than just let's take refuge underground and let him and close the door behind us. Remember, Bilbo convinces them to close the door, sealing them into the mountain before Smaug smashes the mountainside. I can't imagine the film dwarves being like, let's just go into the mountain and close the, into the dragon's den and close the door behind us and sort of sit around here meekly. I don't see them doing that.
Yeah, that's true. And Yana says that Peter Jackson already said he thought the book lacked a confrontation between the dwarves and Smaug.
That's right, he did.
Well, especially with the way that Thorin's character has been built up. And, you know, that element of Thorin wanting vengeance on Smaug for what Smaug did is present in the book. You know, he talks about bringing our curses home to Smaug in chapter one. But you can't shake the fact that when they actually get there, he clearly has no plan and doesn't seem to have a very strong vendetta. He's still focused on the treasure. You know, let's get the treasure. Let's send the burglar down to steal treasure, apparently, because that's what burglars are for. But he doesn't seem to have any, you know, and they're sitting there talking about dragon slayings and how you do it as if they had never thought of that. You know, and Bilbo's pointing this out. This is always he's felt inclined to point out that this had always been rather a weak point in their plans. It's impossible for me to think of movie Thorin, to think of Richard Armitage's Thorin, as never having given any thought to what he would do to the dragon. You kind of get the impression that, you know, especially thinking back to that scene with, you know, young and angry Thorin at the forge that we get in the opening sequence of the Hobbit film one. That he's doing a lot of picturing of what he would do to Smaug given the opportunity. So, you know, I think it's very likely that we're going to get some combat between the dwarves and Smaug, though how that emerges with nobody killed, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I guess if they get the goblin tunnels and the, you know, fall down like 1,000 feet with
stories.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that they would try to confront Smaug as he's flying around the mountain. I would think that they would think about going down to his lair, maybe getting him in close quarters.
Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, I could even, it's, you know, you can't imagine Book Thorin really, you know, saying, I mean, he doesn't say and doesn't seem prepared to say, hey, guys, let's all sneak down together, ambush Smaug while he may be asleep and kill him. You know, I mean, like he has that opportunity, you know, when they first open the door and he's like, let's send in the burglar. So whereas movie Thorin? Absolutely, I can see this. I mean, doesn't that seem like what Richard Armitage's Thorin would do when the secret door opens?
Well, plus it's his home. I mean, this is the home he's been trying. I mean, why on earth would movie Thorin send Bilbo? You know, he seems like he'd be the first one, you know, he'd want to be the first one through the door with his sword out. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Now, Sharon says, or it will just go further to increase Thorin's ire that he didn't get the chance to fight Smaug, and now he's really hankering for a fight. You know, Sharon, I would bet that that's going to come up in film 3. I would be surprised if, you know, because this is not something that really gets emphasized in the book. You know, in the book we have, you know, Bard kind of parading himself as the dragon slayer. You know, you owe me... you know, I am due a share of the treasure because I killed the dragon, you know, and the dragon slayer surely is owed a portion of the dragon's hoard. But there isn't a clear, at least in the book, I don't get the sense that Bard is rubbing that in Thorin's face. But in the film, you know, again, with as touchy as film Thorin is, and as large a picture as Thorin has of, like, you know, the boy who would be king, the guy who feels like he should be king, who's trying to reclaim his lost status, who's trying to reclaim his lost kingdom, for some human to come to him and say, so yeah, that dragon that conquered your kingdom, it was me that killed it, not, by the way, you. So why don't we talk, Mr. I'm sitting up here defending the mountain as if I conquered it, when in fact you did nothing, chump. I'm the one who killed the dragon. I mean, I think that is going to rankle. I agree with Sharon that that's going to make things. I would suspect that's going to contribute to the tension when it comes time for the siege of the Lonely Mountain later on. But to what extent that plays in here, that, you know, we're going to get a near confrontation or would-be confrontation between Thorin and Smaug, or even Thorin talking about, like, I can't wait to get a crack at the dragon. Here's what I'm going to do when I confront the dragon, and then have him be just, you know, biting the heads off of nails that he never gets the chance to do it. I don't know. Because, again, how is he going to be denied the chance? Unless they send Bilbo down to scout things out and everything just goes, you know, haywire in that one try. You know, that Bilbo ends up.
That could be. I mean, yeah, thinking about the
yeah,
toll.
That could be the out. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But I do think it does add a significant new dynamic, I think. But here, Yana, this is an interesting point. Yana says he might send Bilbo because the dragon sickness is starting to affect him. Maybe, but of course, if the dragon sickness is starting to offend him, he might not send Bilbo. That is, he might be less reluctant to say, okay, Burgwer, do your stuff. I don't know. It's one of the open questions that I have a hard time predicting, given the way they've altered Thorin's character. How are Thorin's that? Because Thorin is quite passive in the book, other than that one moment when he gets his one awesome moment of leadership. You know, when Smaug is coming around and they're all scrambling around and Smaug orders Balin and Fili and Kili and Bilbo to get into the tunnel and says the dragon shan't have all of us. I mean, that's Thorin's best moment as a leader prior to his final charge. But other than that, Thorin is kind of a cipher in the whole, you know, dragon sequence in the book. He doesn't go after the dragon. He doesn't, he reassures Bilbo that they do really intend to pay him. But he's not really very heavily involved until, again, he emerges as a more active character once they're down there. And then he starts doing his, you know, the hoard is mine and I am king. And oh, by the way, where's the Arkenstone? Once we get into that element of Thorin, then he really comes to the fore again. But he's kind of he's not a big factor before that. Whereas, again, film Thorin has got to be a factor in one way or another. You guys still there? You totally stumped.
Oh. No,
I'm used to you taking long pauses, so I just figured you were
right. There. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, so I have to go because
We should let you go.
My son is not seeming to go to sleep like he should be. So I've got to get him to bed before it's ridiculously late.
So what's your answer?
Yeah.
My answer is B. C. One visit.
One visit in
movie two.
In movie two.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Where they're going to compress. I guess I just don't see a real reason to have two visits, especially when you've got so much going on in movie two.
Well, of course.
I think they're going to try to stick it in the one.
That is another factor, of course, is that the one of the implicit questions underlying our riddle is about where we think the movie's going to end. If you think the film is going to end prior to them being, you know, say we assume the films are going to have Thorin and company descending and being trapped in the hall like they are in the book, in what is the third visit in the books. Is that sequence, if it does happen in the films, is it going to happen in film two or is it going to happen at the beginning of film three? So that does factor in as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking one because I'm thinking the movie is going to end with the death of the Smaug.
Okay.
That's my thought. So, all right.
Good. Well
it was good to talk to you all.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will talk to you soon.
You certainly will. Thanks, Laura.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye now.
Well, see, now I'm of the opinion that we're not going to have the death of Smaug until the beginning of movie 3, which, again, I know that's a separate episode, and, you know, I may change my mind by that time, but I'm just thinking that we're going to be kind of left hanging with regard to, you know, the dragon's going to take off, but, you know, we're not going to see his death until then. And I'm actually wondering, now, after you talked just now about, you know, how the dwarves could be with regard to confronting the dragon and stuff, I'm also wondering if maybe they... Well, no, I guess not. I was going to say maybe they know that the dragon's dead. You know how that might be a change, is that they know that the dragon's dead even when they're down in the horde. But I guess that really can't be, since Bard's going to kill him. So never mind. It's late. I'm starting to... my brain.
Actually, I want to address this question that Steve just asked, because it's a really good one. Steve says, what would a viable plan look like should Thorin have voiced one? We're going to lure him in here and drop a rock on his head. what exactly would happen? I'm not sure what a viable plan would look like, but I can imagine. Remember that Thorin would likely to have something like a home field advantage here, because presumably he's gonna know Erebor inside and out. So I can imagine Thorin saying, "Okay, huddle up, people. Let me draw you a schematic of this hall and like these places around it. So this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna wait till the dragon's asleep. We're gonna sneak down here. You know, I've drawn, you know, Feely and Keely. I've drawn little X's where you're gonna be in these niches from which you can shoot at him. We're gonna do this down here. We're gonna try to draw him in here, and then you attack him from over here. And then you get when he comes over here, then you guys jump out of there. You know, you could see Thorin doing this kind of thing." And trying to take advantage of, you know, like the architecture of the hall, or to, you know, to basically try to, you know, I mean, obviously any kind of frontal assault on the dragon is, you know, you're going to be the underdogs in that exchange, and they've got to know this. But I think that it is possible that Thorin could propose something a little bit better than, let's just go down there and start a fight, you know.
Well, and, you know, actually what we're basically inferring, I think, in our conversation here is that the whole scene at the Lonely Mountain, you know, during this period, you know, pre-Battle of Five Armies, is going to be very different from what's in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, see, to me, Thorin's character is the number one thing that seems to be necessitated.
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing that, I mean... Because I do like to do this. You know, I like to think about it and say, okay, think of the book plot, and is there anything in the book plot that simply wouldn't work in the film, like that he just couldn't do it this way, you know, given, you know, for one restriction or you know, given to one restriction or another, or given what he's already done in film one. What would be the options? What would be the scenario? And for me, the answer to this question is Thorin. You know, Thorin is the main difference. I can't see things working exactly as they did in the film, because Thorin isn't active enough, and he's not just going to sit around and send Bilbo around and then say, okay, now we have no idea what to do. Pete makes a really interesting suggestion. Pete says, maybe Bilbo will sneak down, see the bear spot, and tell Thorin, who will then plan an attack based on the bear spot. And this then leads me back to Sharon's previous idea. Maybe that does happen. Maybe Bilbo comes back and says, yeah, there's this bear spot. And Thorin says, like, okay, great. We can totally capitalize on that. And then Smaug ends up flying off to Lake Town, and somebody else capitalizes on it. And there's Thorin being like, dang it. You know, that was my plan. I was going to do the shoot him with an arrow in the bear spot thing.
Curses.
Yeah. So I do, you know,
Gone.
Exactly. That could work. That could totally work. Especially if Bard kind of gently rubs it in later on. So can I see Thorin proposing an attack? Yes, I can see Thorin proposing an attack. Can I see Peter Jackson screening an attack, an action sequence with the Dwarven party and Bilbo attacking Smaug? Absolutely, oh, yeah. I can see that. In a heartbeat, I can see that. Does that mean I think it's definitely going to happen? No, I don't think it's definitely going to happen. I can see, and one way to prevent it happening, you know, one alternative to an extended, you know, dwarf Smaug encounter on the mountain would be the precipitous departure of Smaug, which would be facilitated by the compression of Bilbo's visits.
Right.
But
now Jeremy has pointed out something that I did want to make sure that we said, which is what makes C a viable answer. Jeremy's actually saying he's going to go with C, and he says one visit through the hidden door, and then the dwarves attempt to fight or flee down the mountain and find themselves at the front door, as you mentioned before.
Exactly.
And that's one of the reasons why C is a possible answer.
I agree. Jeremy, I think that's a very possible scenario, because here's what I can see. I do think it's unlikely that Smaug that they're going to descend into the mountain and attack Smaug inside the mountain. I don't think that that's going to happen. It could, but I don't think it's going to happen. What I could see, though, or rather what's hard for me to see, is to see Smaug flying around and coming to attack them from the outside, and all of the dwarves simply hiding and not attempting to fight back at all, not even taking one shot at him from the doorway. Rather, what I can imagine them doing is, you know, Thorin urging them to take defensive positions, even planning some kind of, you know, ground-to-air anti-dragon defenses prior, you know, in the event of Smaug's attack, which they then deploy when Smaug comes to attack. So that combat sequence happens, but happens in the context of Smaug attacking them and smashing the door. The door still gets smashed, but they're on the outside because they've been outside defending against him. I can absolutely see that happening. And that could very well lead to them all having to come around in by the front door. And so therefore we do get the C answer. I absolutely can see that. Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing that makes C a possibility even without that is the fact that we're talking movie 2 here.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how movie 2 ends, there still could be a visit to the Horde, you know, by Bilbo et al. In movie 3, and that does not count for this riddle.
Right. Exactly. That would still not count. Okay. Well, here's the other question then. My other question, and we don't have time for a very long conversation on this point, but the question is, when does the Arkenstone come in and how?
Oh, yeah.
Because remember, in the book, the Arkenstone is stolen during visit number 3. Now, there's nothing that says the Arkenstone can't operate in that same place under almost any of these scenarios. That is, if there's only one visit and then a second one, you know, basically there are only two trips down, and it's this, you know, so they compress the first two into one, and then the second trip down is the one where they all end up trapped down there, and then Bilbo finds the Arkenstone. That could happen. There's no reason to say that Bilbo can't still find the Arkenstone when he's there visiting it with the dwarves. If they come in by the front door. But of course there is always the possibility that Bilbo steals the Arkenstone on visit number 1, that he steals the Arkenstone instead of the Golden Cup.
Yeah, no, that's right. It could be in lieu of the cup. And you know, that's on the one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, it could be like it is in the book on the final trip, you know, when everybody goes in and he sees it and pockets it when nobody else sees him do it. I mean, it could happen either way, really. I guess, you know, I mean, we know what's going to be happening with the Arkenstone later. Is it better to reintroduce the Arkenstone in movie 2, or is it better to wait until movie 3 from Jackson's point of view to have the Arkenstone show itself again?
Mm-hmm. Well, I expect to see it. I don't think that necessarily means I expect it to be a major player, but I expect to see it because it's alluded to in the trailer.
Right.
Since it seems that it's going to be, since it appears that weird line, which disturbed everybody in film one about the divine right to rule, is not going to be an isolated throwaway line, but in fact going to really feature in this plot. Since that appears to be the case, I think it's going to show up, at least so we can have some kind of continuity when it comes back, you know, with a vengeance in film three.
Right.
But that doesn't really prove anything. I mean, even if that does happen, that could be accomplished simply by a glimpse of it sitting amongst the horde.
Kind of like the eye of the dragon at the
end of the movie. Exactly, right. We don't even have to see it burgled by Bilbo in order for there to be some kind of continuity.
But
Kate says it might well make an interesting ending to film two, Bilbo picking up the Arkenstone. And Pete was just thinking the same thing too. I think that that's possible. I can definitely imagine that. That would be among my top candidates for closing scene of
two. Yeah.
But I wonder.
This is why we did not include the Arkenstone in the riddle.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Too complicated. So,
well, what do you think? Shall I go ahead and say, I don't know what mine is. I mean, I'm between B and C. And the reason I think I'm between B and C has more to do with the splitting of the movie. You know, I mean, do we just have the one trip and then movie three, we get a second, you know, the second trip. I just don't think there's going to be three trips. I think they are going to compress.
I too think that three is unlikely. I think that the book answer is an underdog in this case, especially since visit one and visit two would be really trivial to collapse together, and you wouldn't even lose all that much in doing so. And I mean, even almost all of the elements from the book could be retained. That is, all of the elements of the Bilbo Smaug confrontations could be retained. I expect that will probably happen. So I think that A is definitely, in my view, an underdog. Not impossible.
I'm going to go with B, mainly because Laura went with C and we need some controversy. I mean, I think it could be either B or C, but I'm just going to go with B to B. And I can still see it. I can still see Wiz having like the two visits, the first visit by Bilbo and the second by the whole company. And I realize I'm saying through the secret door, so that kind of leaves out the
front gate thing.
Yeah, the front gate thing. So,
well, I think that
I'm probably wrong.
The first thing that I start with is I think that we are going to get Bilbo and the dwarves inside Erebor before the end of film two.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do.
For our riddle, it's do they do it by the secret door or do they do it some other way?
Exactly. So for me, that remains my question. I'm pretty convinced that A is not going to happen. As funny as it would be if D turned out to be true, I don't think that's going to happen. And we're going to get Martin Freeman, you know, making fun.
Running up and down.
Hang on, I forgot something. I don't think that's going to happen. And so then to me, the crucial question is, since I think they're going to be down in Erebor prior to the end of this film, do I think they're going to go down by the secret door or not? And I think that they are. So I'm going to go with B also.
You're going with B also.
I think that mostly because I think it's not impossible that the party gets divided. It's a little bit hard for me to reconcile because it's hard for me to reconcile an immediate flight by all of these dwarves in the film. It's hard for me to imagine Smaug is coming, so we're all just going to scurry into the tunnel and hide. I can't see these dwarves reacting that way. So therefore, they're likely to spread out and fight, and it's very hard for me to understand how they're spreading out and fighting and then somehow all getting into the tunnel before it is collapsed by Smaug. That's difficult for me to picture. So I could imagine some of them going down and some of them coming around by the front door or something. Maybe Thorin and Bilbo get separated in this way, or maybe Bilbo alone is this I could
well,
also...
that's the thing. I mean, remember that our riddle is specifically Bilbo. So even if all of the dwarves ended up going through some other way and Bilbo went through the secret door the second time, that counts as a second trip. Right?
Because you see this, I can easily imagine that all of the dwarves spread out and assume they're like battle stations and try to fight off Smaug and doesn't work. And Smaug ends up smashing the secret door. Bilbo, however, might well be hiding right within the entrance of the secret door while the improbable dwarf to dragon defensive combat goes on. Bilbo perhaps quite plausibly thinking he doesn't have too much to contribute to the combat. But then Bilbo could be trapped alone, and that would then make it easier for him to get the Arkenstone, and then he finds him. And in some ways, I actually kind of like that. If that happened, I think symbolically that could work in some interesting ways. I'm not saying I'm necessarily predicting a second solo trip down, but I can imagine that, and that would work with it. So anyway, I'm going with B.
This one's going to be interesting. You know, I mean, I don't know why. I think as I look back, I was thinking this was a pretty straightforward scene for the movie. You know, it's like I hadn't really given it much thought. But boy, after this conversation, I mean, this thing could be, there's any number of ways this whole thing could play out once we get to the mountain.
Well, you know, and who knows, I will laugh so hard if the answer ends up being D. That would be absolutely horrible. Of course, you know, there's another possibility. There's another possibility that the book answer ends up being accidentally correct. That is, that they, in fact, depart quite significantly from the plot of the book, and yet Bilbo ends up going down three times. So we could end up having a non-book book answer, essentially, for this one.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, like, say he sneaks down. I mean, this is basically what Brianna is suggesting here, I think, that Bilbo goes down alone, steals something, comes back out. All of the dwarves go down and Bilbo to try to attack him, and then they're chased down and the door is smashed and they end up going down there the third time for good. That could conceivably happen, and it would be very unlike the book, and yet the book answer. Brianna points out that Bilbo must also come up at least once so that the thrush can learn of Smaug's weak point to inform Bard. Yes, unless we go the Rankin-Bass route, come down with him. And there's plenty of room for a thrush, and the thrush could leave by the front gate, so you know he'd be fine. We could see him emerging from the front gate and flying over the river.
From the rubble, he emerges from the rubble. Brianna's response is no.
Yeah, is that just a general reaction to the idea of this film going a Rankin-Bass route? Is that do you have
any Rankin-Bass route?
Yes. Okay, I was suspecting that was the source of your reaction. Okay.
By the way, I must say, any listeners who haven't seen the Rankin-Bass Hobbit, you should watch it at least just once, just because we make so many references to it.
Yeah.
And it is, some of it is just so, I mean, like what he played tonight about the dragon. I mean, you just gotta see it. Just steal yourself and watch it. It's only 90 minutes, so it's not too bad.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and let me say for the record, I don't hate everything about the Rankin-Bass version. I mean, it is so much, it is so easy to make fun of and so much fun.
It's easy to poke fun at. Yeah.
That, you know, there are actually things that I do really admire about it.
But they don't come to mind off the top of your head.
The main thing I love about them is the songs. The songs in the Rankin-Bass version are brilliant, with the one very notable exception of the theme song. But other than that, the songs, I love the songs in the Rankin-Bass. I think they're absolutely fantastic. But anyway, so there.
I'm saving for year three. I'm saving my rant about how much Rankin-Bass makes Bilbo out to be a coward because he hides in the battle. And
it still
irritates me. So, but we'll do that next year because that's Battle of Five Armies. So.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I'm looking to see what we've got for answers here. So Daniel has said C, I believe.
Ooh, this is an interesting reading of C. Okay, yeah, yeah. Daniel says C is the cup and the conversation happen together. So he goes down once, takes the cup, has the conversation with Smaug. And then when Bilbo attempts to go back to warn of Smaug, and the tunnel collapses before Bilbo makes it to the end. So Bilbo never emerges and is cut off from the dwarves. That way. That's interesting, Daniel. Now, of course, we have the thrush problem. Somehow, I mean, needless to say, this is assuming that the thrush thing is, I don't want to break anybody's heart and even whisper the idea that a thrush is not going to land on Bard's shoulder and whisper to him about the bear spot in Smaug's armor. I assume that everybody else like me is hoping against hope that that will certainly happen. So, anyway,
we still can have the thrush
moth again.
<I'm off>.
Yes. In this film, the part of the thrush will be played by a moth again. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, Daniel says, no, it's fine. The thrush flies out before Bilbo, right? That would assume that the thrush comes down with him again, which yeah. I got to say, it's not just an anti-Rankin Bass sentiment. I don't think that, based upon how they depicted, especially, I mean, the thrush, of course, we've seen the thrush. The thrush appeared at the end of film one. And of course, they seemed to me to be at significant pains to say, I mean, he was acting just like a regular bird. I mean, there was nothing that looked particularly special other than the fact that he was fulfilling an omen and was therefore a bird of omen. He did not seem to be any sort of, you know, a particular special and magical species of thrush, as Thorin suggests of the thrushes of the mountain in the book. So having the thrush, this is the problem, of course, with the thrush in Rankin Bass, is that the thrush in Rankin Bass appears to be like one of the best informed characters of all of them.
He's a sentient thrush.
Exactly. A fully sentient thrush who is like merely, I mean, Bilbo is kind of along for the ride. It's really all the thrush, you know, who actually accomplishes everything. But anyway,
so I'm looking to see who else here has said, let's see. So Daniel said C. I think earlier I noticed, was it John said B? So he's going with B, which is, you know, taking a risk since you and I both said B.
Okay. Yeah. Brianna says B.
All right. Don't any Bravehearts taking us up on D?
Come on, people.
Everybody's wise.
What are you, a bunch of wimps here, not willing to say D? I dare ya. I mean, hey.
Yes, Kate asked, this is Trips Through the Secret Door only.
Yes, Trips Through the Secret Door only. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And also, It's Bilbo, but it doesn't. I mean, it's Bilbo. Bilbo is the essential ingredient, but there could be dwarves with him. In other words, you know, it's not Bilbo. It's not how many times Bilbo alone will go in. It's how many times Bilbo will go in, whether he's accompanied or not.
Yeah. Okay. Hang on. I feel like I have to do my due diligence here. I haven't done my normal thing where I provide a plausible narrative for D. So here it is.
Okay.
Here's the D narrative. Bilbo sneaks down, maybe steals something, maybe her doesn't, but he returns really quickly. Like he just gets a glimpse and runs right back. And he's like, yep, there's a dragon down there and it's really scary. And then Thorin is like, Bilbo, you wuss. Like, fine, we'll show you how it's done. We're gonna go down there and we're gonna like show this dragon what for. So all the dwarves come down with Bilbo on the outskirts and they attack the dragon or attempt to attack the dragon. And then the dragon ends up flying out and they go back up. And this doesn't end in disaster somehow. And next, okay, this is the weak spot of my narrative. But then after this, Bilbo sneaks down a second time and is like, okay, fine. So like, I'm not going to be a coward. Like I'm not afraid to go down there. And then has the conversation with Smaug. And then they take refuge in there later on. That is four trips. Totally, perfectly plausible. Okay, that didn't quite work out exactly, but Anyway,
You gave it. You gave it a good try.
It's close. It's close.
I will also, to defend, Laura's choice of one is, this thing that we've talked about from the get-go, which is how are they going to get everything into the movie? Having there only be one visit in this movie and moving some of the stuff off to movie three, is believable because they have so much stuff they have to cover in this movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, we've had that conversation.
No, it's true. And that is why that's the main reason why I would think that a large number would be implausible, but, but there could be a couple quick trips. It's quite possible.
All right.
Okay. Well, we should go soon. We are over even our normal irresponsible amount of time, and it's late for those of
us. You're even later than you normally go in a lecture.
It's true. I am later than I normally go in a lecture.
You're more overtime than you usually go overtime in a lecture.
Exactly. Being in Eastern time where Laura is in Central time, I have the slight advantage of her in that I was able to put my kids to bed prior to the beginning of the
podcast.
In fact, this is of course why 9:30 is my time for class, for my Mythgard classes, and evening things is after.
I'm taking the philology class. It's going to be so strange after being with you late night classes, to do a Friday afternoon class is going to seem really strange to me.
It's true, yeah. You're going to be in the GMT class. So
that's right. The sun will be out. It'll be weird.
Absolutely. Speaking of, Yana says the sun is beginning to rise over there in Europe. So there we go. There you go.
All right. Well, we should sign off, I guess.
We should sign off. So one thing, of course, that I wanted to mention that I cannot forbear to mention before we sign off, of course, as most of you will have seen, we have officially launched the Mythgard fundraiser on Indiegogo this past week. I just wanted to sort of do a little report on that. It's been really exciting. We have just during our broadcast, actually, passed 48. It's been like, what's today? It's 3 days now. It's been just 3 days of our fundraiser, and we've almost hit 60% of our goal already. So it has been really wonderful. I am hoping that we will be able to do very well there. My goal would be to be able to do these classes year round. So just for those of you who haven't seen the fundraiser yet, what we're doing through Mythgard, I would like to launch a new series of basically totally free and open to the public informal classes. So these would not be classes for MA credit, but these would be classes like the Silmarillion Seminar, essentially, to be able to do those. And I want to let people, let our supporters decide what classes we do. So, we'll do, they'll be open for anybody to sign up for, but the people who have supported the fundraiser will get to nominate and vote on the classes that we'll do, and we'll do as many of them as we can. I've got to be able to pay for the platform, and also we might get guest lectures, that is, people who are not me, to teach some of these classes. That can be one of the things that people can request. Would you like to to discuss your favorite book, and is there a scholar or professor you would like to discuss them with? We can propose that too and see if we can make that happen. I would love to be able to see this happen for quite a bit. So I'm very excited about this. I have been wanting to find a way to do to have more of this kind of stuff available to the public for free for a while. So we decided to try doing the Indiegogo campaign, and that's been really really successful so far, and I'm really happy to see this. I hope to continue the momentum, and I would ask you to consider supporting us. Even little bits help. So definitely check us out on Indiegogo. You can find links. If you go to the Mythgard website, you can find lots of links to our campaign. And certainly on the Tolkien Professor Facebook page and Twitter account, you see plenty of links around there too. So anyway.
Very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah.
The campaign, right? And we're 60%.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the more we do, the more we raise, the more we can do. If we raise, if we blow way past our goals, what I would like to, we could do other special events. You know, I mean, I'd like to do, we could do free and open to the public guest lectures by famous authors and things. I mean, would you like to be able to do an open Q&A with somebody, Neil Gaiman or Jim Butcher or somebody like that? We could do that. You know, I mean, I think that's, if we had the funding, that's definitely something we could do. So that would be good. Yana says a European myth moot. Yana,
maybe
we're thinking about it. I will tell you, Yana, we are thinking about that very seriously. I can't promise anything, but a European myth moot could actually happen. And that's
sooner
definitely,
than later.
That's yeah, right. That is definitely something I'm working on that. So, yeah, Kate says we could get George R.R. Martin in his copious spare time. Exactly.
D-May just got back from Rome, so she's voting for Rome for a European myth boot.
There we go. That'd be lovely. Cool. So anyway, so I just wanted to definitely make sure you guys all knew about that. I encourage you to look at our campaign and support us, at least spread the word if you can. We are definitely excited about being able to kind of take our public offerings here to another level and really sort of expand what we can make available to people.
And to borrow a page from PBS, I will say any amount, I mean, even if it's as low as $5 will help.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, let everybody know, you know, get as many folks. And I just want to say, it's not just for me, it's not just the content of the courses, but it's this whole educational model that Corey has been developing. You know, I mean, I just think high quality education, you know, people doing it out of interest. I mean, I think it's just something really worth supporting, and hopefully will be something that will become replicated as we prove the concept.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, this is definitely something that, that I am excited about for the future, you know, not just for what we can do in these classes, not even just for what we can do in, you know, Tolkien studies and the kind of democratizing of, you know, Tolkien studies that I've been, wanting to work on ever since I started my podcast, but even for higher education in general. I mean, I think that there's a lot that is going on, and I really think that you know, Mythgard and Signum University can really be a big part of that. But you know, we do need people's support. So anyway, so we will be, you know, we will be reminding you about that more in the future. Absolutely. But definitely just wanted to remind people to check that out. Cause I'd be very interested to see, I'm really interested to see what kind of classes people would want to do. I mean, I have in my own mind, you know, the list of things that I would do if I could just choose, you know, a full year's worth of discussion classes to have. But I am very, you know, I am determined to follow through with my pledge to leave this to the people. So I'll be interested to see what people choose. It's for me kind of a fun thing. To sort of imagine being a.
Steve asked, "Can we pay? Is there a way to PayPal it, or is?"
Absolutely, yeah. Steve, the Indiegogo accepts both PayPal and credit cards, so that's actually, in fact, PayPal is preferable, honestly, because if you contribute by PayPal, we get it right away. If you contribute, we have to wait till the end of the campaign. absolutely, it is PayPal compatible. So, by all means. But anyway, Well, very good. Well, thanks everybody again for joining us. This has been a long but fun discussion, which has covered a lot of different ground. We will probably find, we've been kind of talking around this subject for a while. We will probably get around to discussing the end, the end stage of the film, and in the context of that, to me, what discussing the end of the film really means is not just kind of the minutiae of, at what precise moment or with what scene does the film end, but rather, what is the overall shape of the plot arc of this film going to be? How do we really see the overall structure of the story that film two is telling unfolding? To me, that's really the big question that goes into the question of where it ends. And I'm really interested to kind of step back a little bit and think about that more. Anyway, so that's probably what we will do next time. I said we've been putting that off for a while. No promises, but that's probably what we will do. So we will see you guys in 2 weeks-ish. Not been very regular in our times. Our schedules have been a little wacky lately, but anyway, 2 weeks. Thanks again for joining us, everybody. And as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed.